All right, Craig, let's go.
Are you hanging up your stocking?
We're so out of time.
Whoa!
We're violently out of time.
Are you more ways hanging than one. Up your stocking on your wall?
Yes,
it is. It's no encore.
It's no encore.
It's no encore.
Happy no encore, everybody. My name is Dave Hanratty. There will be no encore. It's Christmas, Craig. How are you feeling?
Season's greetings, Dave. I'm getting quite Christmassy.
All right.
It's been a grim week. I don't think I've seen the sun in quite a long time. I'm overly tired, and I turned on Christmas FM this afternoon, Dave.
To get in the mood for this episode, was it?
To kind of get in the mood and do some like research for like 5 minutes, and it was everything you would expect and more. The first song that greeted me was a song called I Want a Hippopotamus for Christmas. And then like the DJ came on, who I'm not sure who it was, I won't throw anyone under the bus, but it was kind of like a little Larry Gogan vibe going on. And the outro kind of link was one of these, I'd like to meet that songwriter and really get inside their mind and be like, why a hippopotamus for Christmas? So there was some chat about the hippopotamus, and then we moved quickly into like a birthdays roundup for people. It was very standard radio fare. There was a lot of, oh yeah, then there was a list of like celebrity birthdays today. I don't know if you know anyone of these, Dave, but they opened with Italian fashion designer Gianni Versace, who is sadly no longer with us, was the line.
Yeah.
Britney went turned 40.
Went well for him. Congratulations to her.
Yeah. Michael McDowell, great. Yeah. It was interesting. I turned it off quite quickly. That was my Christmas FM experience.
Okay, well, you know, congratulations to all involved. We'll try and have a similar experience on this show. It is, of course, top five Christmas songs on this episode, best and worst. Craig is on best, and I'm the Grinch this week. I've been informed already, so I guess I'll embrace that role, and I'll bring you five of the very worst Christmas songs you could possibly imagine. I have such sights to show you. You've no idea. But before we get going, real quick, there's a brand new Before the Encore episode out now with Jar Jar Jr. as conducted by the wonderful, the amazing sonic architect Adam Shanahan. That is in your podcast feed right now, so go check it out. Also, just a note, our release schedule for the end of the year, I guess it's time to reveal it, is it? We've one more regular episode coming probably next week. We need to just coordinate that.
Yeah.
We'll see what happens there. But we are going to record our end of year episodes next weekend, and thus try and get them out the week after and the week after. So this is the penultimate, I think, regular episode of the show, unless disaster strikes next week, we'll see. But I guess we can announce that returning to the end of year SmackDown alongside myself and Craig will be the one, the only, the contentious fireball that is Zara Hederman. She'll be joining us for the final episodes of the year. So I guess we'll see what she has to bring to the table. I'm sure it will be low-key. I'm sure there'll be no arguments whatsoever or disputes. And I'm sure it will be very entertaining for the listener. So that's coming up later in the month.
Contentious fireballs usually are.
As we get ready to close the shutters down for another year. And it's been a hell of a year. And I want to thank everybody for staying with us. Especially this week, by the way, when Spotify Wrapped dropped. And I got to see a lot of people putting the podcast in their top five most listened to or their most listened to or whatever.
Yeah.
It means a lot for us to see that. That's a very nice thing to see. Thank you very much for everyone who supports the show. And also to remind you as well that if you want to go the extra mile, you can do so at patreon.com/noencore. There's a brand new episode of No Oxcore out now on that feed. patreon.com/noencore if you're feeling in the Christmassy giving mood to help out the show. No pressure at all. But the only pressure I put upon you, listener, is to just tell your friends about the show. Let's increase that listenership, Craig, and let's do so with a great episode ahead of us. And the like all great
Again,
episodes.
Again, no pressure.
Well, there's pressure on me now as the host. Yeah, well, look, like all good podcast episodes should begin, we will begin with this.
Hey, you heard about the good news?
That's right, and it's time to haul Brian May over the coals yet again after last week's story in which we talked about him saying some contentious comments. He has, of course, since taken to Instagram to clarify. So last week, he was at an ITV event and he just discussed, I guess, described about how, you know, these days Freddie Mercury, you know, might be a harder pill to swallow, etc. There's all kinds of ways of describing things in the world these days that might not jibe with that. And both you and I were kind of like, this doesn't really make a lot of sense.
It's confusing, yeah.
It was confusing. It didn't seem like it was incredibly mean-spirited. It sounded like he was just kind of trying hard to, you know, make sense of things and got it completely wrong. But he has now said that he was, in fact, stitched up by a journalist, that his words were twisted and taken out of context. And he said, and I quote, "I was ambushed and completely stitched up by a journalist at the recent ITV event. It led to a whole mess of press stories making it look like I'm unfriendly to trans people. Nothing could be further from the truth. My words were subtly twisted."
Subtly is an interesting word to inject in there, isn't it? Subtly twisted.
One way or the other.
Were they his words? I mean, it seems like it.
Well, I've seen a lot of people, I saw like this week a lot of people on Twitter and elsewhere saying that like, this is what journalists, tabloid journalists do all the time. Like they do take you out of context. And they do.
Yes,
but
they
what
do.
They generally, what they... I was going to say generally, but generally, you know, like if you're quoting someone, you kind of got to quote them. You kind of got to say what they said. And I feel like what was quoted was what he said. I think he just made a bit of a fucking mess of it. I don't think Brian May is anti-trans. I don't think he's a horrible human being. I think he just was trying to make some kind of weird modern day point and it got away from him. I'm going to give him the benefit of the doubt.
These things happen when you're at ITV's Palooza event, you know? Heat of the moment, the spectacle's kicking off, we're heading into Christmas, and he probably just got a bit lightheaded and started speaking and then just sadly for him didn't quite stop. But yeah, the statement on Instagram was, it did clarify pretty much everything. I mean, he addressed all of humanity and indeed existence and the universe as he apologised to anyone who has been hurt by the stories. He emphasised that his heart is open as always to humans of all colours, all creeds, all sexes and sexualities, all shapes and sizes and all creatures. We all deserve respect and an equal place in this world. Merry Christmas. I just added that bit. But yeah, I mean...
Happy holidays.
I don't know what more he could have said, really. And we did give him kind of the benefit of the doubt last week, didn't we? I mean, he seems like someone with his heart in the right place. Maybe, you know...
Yeah, I mean, it seemed like he was tying himself up in knots. He was trying to be like, oh, if Queen was happening these days, we'd be forced to have, like, you know, a minority person or
that
like
was
someone
that was
of,
the weird thing about the comments,
sexuality.
Though, wasn't
and it's like,
it? Because one of
it
his points
Queen.
Seemed to be that,
like, it's just yeah, like,
one of his points seemed to be that, like, Freddie Mercury would be seen as like tough to swallow because he was different. But then, by the same token, he was saying they would have had to bring different people into the group. It just made no sense.
It doesn't make sense because, like, when you think about it, like, I mean, like, Freddie Mercury has been this kind of cross-cultural icon
yeah.
to the point where, you know, the average bloke on the street who might ordinarily have prejudice in his heart probably fucking loves Freddie Mercury. Like there was this weird thing where, like, it didn't apply. There wasn't. I mean, I'm sure there was. I'm sure there were fucking assholes who were horrible about him because of his sexuality and whatever. But at the same time, Queen did transcend the mainstream and became this huge thing, and it seemed like it wasn't an issue, and if anything, Freddie Mercury may have made some people think differently in a positive way. So it was kind of like, I could maybe understand this from, like, you know, I don't know, like Avenged Sevenfold. I don't know what they're like. Maybe they're sound. But like Queen, you know, I was like, it's Queen. Like, what? Come on.
Yeah.
It's already there. But yeah, look, listen, Brian May, I think he just fucking put his foot in it. And we'll let it go. I also think the journalist probably reported what he said. So it's like two things can be true, you know? But we'll move on to another person who feels that they have in fact been stitched up by the press. And in fairness, I think she has been for a very long time. We're talking Yoko Ono, Craig. She shared an article online, I think also potentially via Instagram, which says that the new Peter Jackson Beatles documentary Get Back, which I feel like a lot of people have been watching over
yeah,
the last few days, dispels rumors that she broke up the group. So a lot of people, I've seen a lot of takes about this documentary over the last week, and most of them have been absolutely gushing. But some people have also said that, if anything, this documentary once again proves that Yoko Ono was, in fact, a horribly massacred scapegoat, and it was a classic case of a woman being blamed for men's folly. I want you to comment on that, but I also want to hear what you think about the documentary, because I think you have watched it.
I've watched part one. Yeah, I've only seen part one. There's three parts, so I'm just the 2.5 hours deep, Dave. I had a lovely Sunday.
It's quite long, yeah.
It's very long, it's very languid, and initially it opens with a very, like, cheap History Channel kind of like recap of what the Beatles had been up to that point, with some like very cheap looking visuals. And I was like, okay, what's this going to be like? And then you get into them in a big warehouse, messing about, having no songs. And 20 minutes in, you're just like, it's just, is this like the biggest waste of my time? And then it just hooks you in. It's like, it's hypnotic. It's totally like, it's so close to any kind of painstaking creative process, any kind of grouping of friends just trying to make something happen together. It's, and like the quality of the footage is amazing, so you feel like you're right back there. And they all look fantastic as well. And listen, I'm no fan of like cigarettes and smoking and that stuff, and don't smoke people, but they look so fucking cool, just blazing up. You're kind of right back there. And yeah, I mean, definitely from part one does dispel that kind of, you know, Yoko Ono rocked up and decided to just warp John Lennon's mind, and you know, was kind of the straw that broke the camel's back in terms of the band breaking up. I think at this point, as the documentary opens, Ringo's already left the band once for a different album. George seems displeased. Yoko was there with John, kind of just like as a supportive presence, but like she's kind of just knitting for a lot of it and sitting around politely. She's not interjecting. John Lennon, to a large extent, isn't interjecting either, because it seems, I'm pretty sure he was on heroin at the time. So he's quite a mellow presence compared to Paul McCartney, who's very much in like, hey guys, let's keep the band together and actually do some work, yeah? And do you have any songs? And like at one point he's talking to John Lennon, he's like, I'm wondering if you're going to like come in with any like songs, you know? And eventually he's like, okay, yeah, here's Across the Universe. Meanwhile, Paul McCartney's like, everyone's been talking about that moment when Get Back actually gets written, and it's just like very drab, very mundane weekday morning where they're waiting for John Lennon to turn up with Yoko Ono, and Paul McCartney's just sitting there with a bass and starts mumbling, trying to write a song because they've got no songs. And Ringo and George Board just look on as he creates Get Back. It's sensational. It's great.
I've seen that scene. I haven't seen the documentary because obviously it doesn't appeal to me, but I have seen that clip during the rounds. And I mean, I don't know, maybe the magic is lost on me because, of course, I'm a bit of a Beatles.
A lot depends on whether you like that song, because if you don't, then you're kind of like, well, he's just mumbling into a mumbly song, isn't he?
I don't like that song, I will say. And also, I've seen a lot of people online being like, oh my God, like, Jesus, they're sitting there and then they just bounce ideas off each other, and the next thing you know, they have a song. And I'm like, yeah, that's songwriting, guys. That's how songwriting goes.
I get, yeah, that is very true. But I guess what's refreshing about it is, with so many music documentaries and kind of band, you know, making of the album stuff, it's all talking heads. Do you know what I mean? Not the band, but it's just people sitting around like 30, 40 years later going, and then we just had this moment of like divine inspiration in the studio, and like we, you know, I played the G chord, so suddenly everything fell into place.
So to actually see it in real time.
To actually see it,
fair enough,
such a way that it's not really being, because the footage, there's so much footage and it's so languid, it doesn't feel like there's this big hype around it. It's not really spotlit. It's just a part of that day. Do you know what I mean? So there's something magical, I guess, in the mundane. Yeah,
exactly. I was going to use that exact word. I was going to say, like, because it's mundane, and because something comes out of it that you recognize as a great song, you're like, oh wow, yeah, you're making a good point here. And I am obviously applying my cynicism here for effect to a degree, but I mean, like, yeah, it must mean a lot more to you as a fan than, say, watching like Bohemian Rhapsody, where like they have the scene where they write, you know, fucking We Are the Champions, whatever, and you're like, or We Will Rock You, which is a hilarious cartoon scene in the movie. But I suppose to actually see the actual footage of it actually happening with the people that wrote it and stitched it together in that way. But also, can I ask you, like, does that dispel myth for you? Like, does that almost make it a bit less magical?
No, I think actually seeing them more as three-dimensional human beings actually improves it, to be honest. It does dispel a lot of myths, and I think that's what's good about it, because there is the Yoko thing. There is the thing in general of, you've heard these stories about how the band made these albums, how they eventually broke up, and it becomes these very black and white tales, and you kind of think, oh, at this point Paul and John were barely speaking to each other, or, yeah, no, you hear about that time like George stormed off. And what you don't get is all the colour and all the real life stuff that's in Get Back, where it's like, well, actually most of the time they're just like a bunch of quite pleasant seeming English blokes in their 20s who are actually having a good time for a lot of, you know, together. And there's a lot of kind of passive aggressive stuff, but then they might disagree on something, but they're just kind of joking about 5 minutes later and you forget all that kind of stuff. There's, you know, in the kind of myth, there was nothing about when, and spoilers here, George walks out, and spoilers, yeah, he actually rejoined the band, but he walks out and they kind of don't know what to do. And Ringo's like, will we just like split up his instruments and call it a day? And the rest of the day is them becoming like this noise rock band where Yoko is screaming into a mic and Paul McCartney's like losing his mind on guitar. And you're like, I want that album. I want McCartney and fucking Yoko doing a noise rock album. They clearly didn't have that much of a problem with each other. They clearly got on 90% of the time, and they were clearly just normal human beings, and that's why I like it.
You've only seen part one, but who is the star of the show so far?
Well, McCartney's kind of the driving force, right? Because as I was saying, at this point, Lennon's checked out. I think he's like decided he's going to leave the band, but he's not really, not in an aggro way, and he's, I think, clearly using heroin. So he's quite mellow, and letting other people kind of take the lead. George is really interesting character, but getting frustrated, I think. So Paul McCartney is fascinating just through sheer work rate, and Ringo is a very lovable dude who's clearly the drummer that's realized he's onto a real fucking winner with this group, and he's just like, I'm going to be as lovable as possible and get on with everyone and make some jokes and keep time, and that's what he does, and it's a great watch.
I'm going to be Switzerland. Let's bring it back to Yoko Ono though, who we started the story about. How do you feel about her place in history? And do you think that this documentary, I was going to use the word exonerates her, that's probably not a fair word to use, but there are, maybe you can tell me more about this, because I've only seen skirmishes, sideline stuff. You're probably more invested in the Beatles' history. It does seem to be that she has been this pilloried figure throughout the years, and it does seem to be quite misogynistic. Yeah. What do you think about the whole thing?
I think there's been a sea change in maybe the last 5, even 10 years, where people have realised actually these were just a group of mates that had probably gone on longer than they should have in terms of the problems within the relationships, and there was problems there before Yoko turned up. I think that attitude change gladly had kind of shifted. But yeah, you're right. For absolutely decades, she was seen as kind of this wicked witch almost, this complete caricature of a person, as opposed to an artist in her own right. And she clearly brought out the best, I think, in John Lennon, who is a very conflicted, problematic
guy.
Yeah, problematic character. I mean, he was open in, you know, in the 70s when, you know, after being with Yoko a bit and kind of learning to grow up and mature and become a father and kind of getting into his more peaceful stage, he was the one that openly talked about how angry and violent he was as a younger man in his 20s, and he came from a kind of broken home and all that kind of stuff. So I think his evolution as a human being, certainly by the time he passed away, he seemed to be in a completely different place, and that was after a steady relationship with Yoko Ono. So I think that was a great success of that relationship. That's a testament to her. And then, yeah, she's a, you know, very respected artist in her own right. I've heard some of her stuff. I mean, the noise pop thing doesn't exactly do it for me, but some of her live performances are great. She's great on Twitter. I think she's great all around. She seems to be, you know, in, there was that kind of, she was on the outs with McCartney for a long time, it seemed like, or it was at least icy, but they seem to have made friends at this point. And a kind of nice ending to the story, I guess, all these years on.
Well, maybe someday she'll be recognised as a national hero, but for now, someone else who has in fact received that exact honour is Rihanna. No new album, but national hero status confirmed. This comes off the back of a very interesting news development during the week. Barbados, where she is from, yeah, is now no longer part of the British monarchy. It is now an independent state, and as part of the ceremony, which saw Prince Charles there, by the way, for doing a handover, I suppose.
Yeah. Seems to
Rihanna,
have to do a lot of that kind of stuff. Just like the Commonwealth slipping away. Here I am,
I'm
again,
an ambassador.
Apologising, yeah.
A lot of apologies. Rihanna was, as part of the ceremony, was named officially a national hero by the Prime Minister, Mia Mottley, who said, on behalf of a grateful nation, but an even prouder people, we therefore present to you the designee for National Hero of Barbados, Ambassador Robin Rihanna Fenty. May you continue to shine like a diamond and continue to bring honour to your nation by your words, by your actions, and to do credit wherever you shall go. She is the 11th person, and and only the second woman to be named a national hero of Barbados, and she can now put the words Right Honourable in front of her name. Craig, are you happy and proud? And also, do you want that new album that seems to never be happening?
I mean, yes and yes. Right Honourable Rihanna sounds tremendous. I must admit, when I first saw like the headlines around this story, some of the way it was framed seemed to suggest that they were just replacing the Queen with Rihanna. Do you know what I mean? I was
fine
like,
by oh, me.
You've just become a republic, but now you're making Rihanna the kind of benevolent dictator, which I think, you know, if she wants to come over here and do the same job, that's grand. But no, it's as you say, she's the 11th person, so rarefied air, to become a national hero. And I guess doing it at that ceremony just kind of draws attention to the whole thing. So it's a good, I mean, good PR work by Barbados. If the Prime Minister had dropped the news that like, new Rihanna album out now, I mean, that would have been tremendous. What a first act from a new republic.
They should have done that. In other news this week, we talked last week about Rod Stewart and his penchant for making love to his wife, like 15 men.
We did, yeah. Thanks for reminding me.
He's gone on the attack in a different way this week. He's gone after our own Royston Keane. So, football fans of this show will probably know that last weekend, after Manchester United battled to a valiant 1-1 draw at Stamford Bridge with Chelsea, Roy Keane and Jamie Carragher got into it on Sky Sports for the benefit of social media and engagement. They had a big row. They were screaming at each other. I thought it was kind of embarrassing. People seemed to like it, though. Rod Stewart, however, has called Roy Keane a bully and said, you know, I admired him as a player, but he's a bit of a bully. I think there's a way of speaking your mind, and then there's a way of speaking your mind, and he's far too aggressive. He was an elite player, but do you think he could be a good manager with that approach? Well, Rod, we have the answer, because he has managed before,
yeah,
terribly, so not. What do you think about Rod Stewart getting involved here? I think we've talked before on this show about how Rod Stewart is ultimately probably a bit of a kitten. He's a bit of a meek man. I kind of fear for him if Roy Keane decides to go after him. What do you think?
Rod's an interesting one because, yeah, huge football fan. We've spoken before about how he's got an actual full-size football pitch like out his back garden, and he's spoken before about how he's like suddenly dawned on him that he didn't know enough people that would
he's
ever
no
want
one to play.
Play
with.
So him and the dogs just so run around on it. He's been doing the rounds promoting his new album, so I've caught him in some like unlikely places. He was on Ezra Koenig's podcast, or internet radio show, should I say, and he was talking about he's really into model trains and model railways as well. Like so much so that he brings them all on tour with him, and he has a separate hotel room set up just with his model trains, which is fascinating.
Outrageous.
And then I stumbled across a thread where people were like baffled by lyrics from his new album. Do you want a taster of the chorus of?
Well, after last week's lyric taste, I do. Yeah,
Bama, cuckoo arama bama. Yeah, cuckoo arama bama, Dave.
All right.
The chorus goes: "There's a fire down below. There's a fire down below. Sex is cool and sex is nice. Sex will leave you in paradise. Sex is good for everyone. Come on, people." Let's have some fun right now. Kukukurama-bama, whatever it is. And it goes on in that fashion. So he hasn't lost it. You were saying he's
no.
A bit of a meek kitten. Bit of a sex kitten, you asked me.
Okay,
Dave.
Okay, no, right. Let's close off the news section with a wholesome news story because I feel like I need to take 15 showers, as it were.
He's also a Tory, apparently, which is
oh,
bad.
Is he?
Yeah.
For fuck's sake,
yeah,
who is
Celtic fans don't like him. Yeah. Anyway.
Okay. Well, they don't like Anthem. Taylor Swift has sent Don McLean flowers and a handwritten note after breaking his Hot 100 record. Her new song, All Too Well, the 10-minute version, you know, the Taylor's version thing,
yeah,
dethroned Don McLean's 8-minute track, American Pie Parts 1 and 2, held the top position. It's the longest number one entry, so like the longest song, essentially. So, speaking to Billboard after his defeat, Don McLean said, "There's something to be said for a great song that has staying power. American Pie remained on the top for 50 years. I think it's just celebrated its 50th anniversary. And now Taylor Swift has unseated such a historic piece of artistry. Let's face it, no one ever wants to lose the number one spot. But if I had to lose it to somebody, I sure am glad it was another great singer-songwriter such as Taylor." So he put up a photograph on Twitter of him smiling with these flowers that kind of looked crap, if I'm honest with you.
Oh.
And this handwritten note that looked like it was written by a serial killer, which said, and I quote, "Don, I will never forget that I'm standing on the shoulders of giants. Your music has been so important to me, sending love from one writer of long songs to another. Your fan, Taylor." Now, the Swifties online, as they are, very quickly deduced that it wasn't her handwriting at all.
So,
yeah.
So Taylor Swift has a potential serial killer working for her on her team.
Yeah, probably, yeah.
Okay. You know. I thought it was going there. Does this feel kind of passive aggressive or no? I guess she means well because
no,
you know
she means well.
Don's being quite.
Sorry, Craig. Write the fucking note yourself. Yeah, like, what? Come on.
Particularly when she is so canny in terms of social media, and she must know, and the team must know that he's likely to put this up online, and then the Swifties are going to pour all over it. Right. That's why I'm thinking: is there some? I don't know. Don McLean's been very magnanimous. We've spoken before about this guy as well, and fair to say he's a bit of an American Tory, right? Isn't he? He's not the best dude, I think. His, you know.
Remind me?
His ex-wife made some accusations about him, only about a year previously. I won't get into all of them, but I think one of them that was established was that he completely cut off his daughter and just financially and stuff. And there was some very, very biting comments and just... There's been stories about Don McLean over the years. He's a bit of a curmudgeon, I think, at best, right? Even that statement is just like quite self-aggrandizing in his little post-match interview about the defeat, where it's, you know, such a historic piece of artistry, etc., etc. And yeah, I don't know. I'm glad he's been dethroned, even if it is by Taylor. I did like the last line of this story, though, which you kind of alluded to earlier. Don McLean is currently celebrating the 50th anniversary of American Pie. Like, it's a perpetual celebration. Like, right now, he's currently celebrating all year long. He's just, like, on a bouncy castle.
You
50 years, baby!
Reach for comments. He said, yeah. So, hang on, by the way, before we move on, American Tory sounds like a hell of a split album between Rod Stewart and Don McLean, doesn't it?
I'm here for it, yeah. I would listen to at least two tracks of that.
Okay. Well, why don't we listen to some Christmas songs, Craig? Because my question to you and to you, listener, is, are you hanging up your stocking on your wall? It's time. We've no album review this week because we've pretty much pulled the shutters down on new album reviews. We'll be moving to our end of year episodes quite soon. It's been a hell of a year, but we'll get to that in a couple of weeks. For now, though, it's time for me to get sad because I find Christmas to be a very melancholic time of year. And yet... I have, in fact, agreed to this top five. Craig, how did you ever talk me into this?
I said you could do worst, and you jumped at the chance.
Pretty much,
it was your turn, in fairness. And so it worked out really well. And it's obviously a huge topic that we kind of had to cover. The time is right. The moon is right.
The moon is right.
To quote Paul McCartney. I don't know if we'll get there. But yeah, it's rich pickings, I guess. My approach on best was... There were so many different ways I could go because I could have gone the full bore hipster thing of just finding really well written songs that allude to Christmas or just have, you know, wintry settings. I decided to go Christmas songs. Do you know what I mean? These have to be things I will put on when I want to get
in. By the way, but whatever.
When I want to get in the mood for the season. Do you know what I mean? So I think this might be the closest I veer in terms of best songs towards like... guilty pleasure territory, but I don't believe in guilty pleasure. I don't know if you do either, but
we're done with guilty pleasures.
Clear of like diving into, you know, the back catalogue of like Low or something and finding some like really well written indie song they had referencing Christmas 20 years ago. Do you know that kind of thing? Like, I did, it's not in keeping with the season of perpetual hope, Dave. What was your approach?
My approach was trash. This is.
I wonder will there be any crossover.
I have a bag full of trash, and I'm going to gift it to all the listeners. I've got a bulletproof top five. I had to stop. I was like, okay, this is the five. There's no point in trying to find other stuff because I think I will just ruin what I have. This could have been a top 30. This brought me back to the country episode. It was just an endless well of. Absolute horror.
Did you do some digging to get like truly atrocious stuff, or were you just like, this stuff is so ingrained in my brain already, I can just write this list here now?
Combination of both, I think. There are three songs. My top three actually are ones that I was very familiar with, but my first couple that will be coming up here are ones that I was not previously. And as a matter of fact, why don't I just horrify everybody with a discovery I made this week, and much like the cursed videotape from Ring, I'm going to pass it on to you, dear listener. Here's my number five in the worst Christmas songs.
I'm at my run at the break of day.
You know, it's really Craig who should be apologizing, not me, because Craig picked this top five, and thus, here we are, with Bon Jovi and Backdoor Santa. That's right, it's called Backdoor Santa. It's a cover, would you believe?
Get behind me, Santa.
It's a cover. It's a funk-style song written by Clarence Carter in 1968, described as a superbly funky Christmas single and, quote-unquote, raunchy. It sure fucking is. Some of those lyrics, they call me Backdoor Santa, I make my runs about the break of day, I make all the little girls happy while the boys go out to play. And then, of course, Bon Jovi really leaning into the C word there in the chorus. I was flabbergasted by this. It was just, the song starts off like, I mean, imagine Eddie Van Halen's Jump, but the song itself is having a cocaine overdose.
Yeah.
Like, just this insane synth. And then, like, this horrendous guitar. Bon Jovi clearly at the height of, you know, slicked hair, feathered hair, and just, like, fucking horrendous slippery when wet pomp going on in the 80s. It's clearly meant to be a joke. It's clearly meant to be, hey, let's have a bit of fun with this. Clearly just the height of excess, but nonetheless, I found it disgusting, Craig. I found
horrible.
It
horrible. Even garish. The sound of it is...
It's so badly... Yeah, oh, everything sounds like it's...
I need a shower. Like, I need a cold shower.
I know. Everything sounds like it's at war with itself. Nothing seems to be mixed correctly. Everything is just larruping in. It's like a Christmas house on fire. It's horrendous. It's horrific. And I felt it was the best way to announce this top five. And, you know, I won't apologize. I think Craig is the one who has to, as I said at the top of the show.
I apologize. That was really bad. couldn't believe what I was hearing. And also,
Backdoor,
you know,
Santa, Craig.
Yeah, it's kind of take on Christmas that I was trying to avoid with my choices. Just in terms of, like, as you were saying, it's clearly going for, like, an ironic, look at us, we're having some fun with Christmas, but they're having too much fun with it, and to the point that, like, they should probably be arrested. so I wanted to steer clear of those kind of ironic songs. I have one, like... indie hipster token choice. It's not even indie hipster, it's just like people that would listen to the show will probably like this artist, but I still had strict rules to adhere to, right?
Oh, so strict rules.
One, yeah,
okay.
I mean, yeah, well, everyone knows the only way to fully maximize the wonder of the most wonderful time of the year is to have strict rules, Dave.
the chief medical officer over here, everybody. Yeah.
But I was steering clear, as I said, of like Christmas tourists, you know, no one just having a go, right? No kind of classy ballads with a bit of like jingle bells stuck in there. So I've gone with
professionals
someone,
only, is it? Yeah,
professionals only. I've gone with someone who has put in the work, put in the hard yards, and released something like 200 Christmas songs. This is the pick of the bunch.
Sorry, I'm just going to interrupt here and quote Craig from approximately 4 minutes ago when he said, I didn't go hipster with this. Craig, do you want to tell us who this is?
Sufjan Stevens, and it's Christmas in the Room from an EP that was put out in 2008, I believe, but also was included on the box set or the digital. I had a digital version when I had to review Silver and Gold, which had something like 70 songs. It was 160 minutes long. It was 3 stars. There was a lot of good stuff in it, but it was tremendously long. And this is a man who's committed to Christmas, committed to Christ as well, I believe. Really interesting artist who kind of, you know, brings his fate into a lot of what he does. So he's well placed for this kind of work. I also think his sound lends itself really well to nodding towards the kind of commercial mainstream aspects of Christmas music. It's that primary colour thing. It takes in the kind of joyous jingliness of the season. So, yeah, I felt like he was a good person to include. There's some quotes from Sufjan as well, just talking about, his take on the genre and why he's so interested in it. And he says, the elusive Christmas hit usually has an indelible melody, clever wordplay, and juxtaposition of conflicting consciousness, joy and heartache, or sacred and profane. Christmas is a catch-22. We celebrate God-made man with luxurious feasts and revelry in the dead of winter, when nature is least inviting. The best Christmas songs, even the secular ones, tap into this bipolar emotional field. Like I'll Be Home for Christmas looks sentimental on the surface until you get to the last line and realize the context in which it was proliferated. It was commonly sung at USO shows during World War II. It's both a sentimental love song and a depressing military anthem. Love the Michael Bublé version, which I just added that last bit. But he makes a good point. And I think Christmas in the Room is a really good example of that juxtaposition. It probably would have worked well as a pandemic Christmas song, you know what I'm saying? There's no decorations, no people calling around. But I think he gets at... He's talking about a different Christmas and, you know, we all choose to celebrate it differently and some of us choose not to celebrate it at all. But I think what he's trying to get at is how there's something compelling about like our human need to find like a cause for celebration at this kind of grim time of the year and defer to like a higher power, whether it's the birth of Christ or like, I don't know, a manic Ryan Tuberty on the toy show and, you know, engaging in mystical rituals of like paper hats and crackers and all that kind of stuff. So basically what I'm saying, Dave, is that Christmas is really inside you if you want it to be. And if you don't want it to be, that's okay too, because that's what Christmas is all about. And that's my number five.
Deep stuff, Craig. Profound. True, probably. I mean, Sufjan Stevens has a reputation for being a bit of a melancholic artist. Maybe not entirely fair, but he can certainly bring a room down. However, I'm going to bring the room all the way down with my number four. Let's go.
Merry Christmas. I turned around and saw my mama's tears. Please, Daddy, don't get drunk this Christmas. I don't want to see my mama cry.
Take Me Home, Country Roads. It's John Denver, everybody. And Please, Daddy, open brackets, don't get drunk this Christmas, close brackets. Upsetting, I would say, Craig. An upsetting song.
Yeah. Country. My face, my heart, everything just sank.
Head into hands. Country ditty there. A 2.5 minute song. So fair play. Brevity. Yeah, a really fucking weird one, right? So this is pretty much the entire song. It's straight in, and it's about this fucking kid who is dealing with a very difficult situation at home. Clearly an alcoholic father and a potentially abusive one. And I don't know. I mean, like, I felt bad about
it. How does it end? Do I want to know?
Oh, it ends with him just refraining the chorus. There's no happy ending here. He's just like, I don't want to see my mama cry. And it's like, okay. Where's the happy? There isn't one. Okay. But what's weird about this is that, like, John Denver has a reputation, I think, for being fairly upbeat in his songs. That might be a blanket statement that I'm not qualified to make, but I would have thought of him as a wholesome kind of guy. So I'm going to quote now from an article from a journalist by the name of Alex Robert Ross, as quoted in Vice in 2018. So here's a couple of paragraphs from him. Given his Ain't Life Something reputation, it shouldn't come as a surprise that Denver did not write Please Daddy by himself. The original songwriters weren't known for their pitch black social realism either. The song is credited to Bill Danoff and Taffy Nivert, the then married couple best known for fronting the Starland Vocal Band and penning Afternoon Delight, the massive nitrous happy ode to daytime sex. They first came up with Take Me Home Country Roads, and after deciding not to sell it to Johnny Cash, gave it to John Denver, apparently. So why did Denver record Please Daddy, Don't Get Drunk This Christmas in the first place? He didn't seem to hate the holidays. Rocky Mountain Christmas, which is the album this is taken from, is an almost nauseatingly family-friendly record, comprised mostly of standards like Silent Night and Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. There's an earnest, adult, contemporary version of Jingle Bells towards the end. And on the record, Please Daddy, Don't Get Drunk This Christmas is sandwiched between Silver Bells and a more twinkly and romantic Denver original called Christmas for Cowboys. He even starred in a Muppets TV special called A Christmas Together. So why did he write this song? There's no real answer, no obvious reason why Denver decided to point to a broken home on this, a song that he did not write. It's a very strange curio, and I listened to it a few times this week, Craig, and every time I listened to it, I was like, surely there's going to be a light at the end of the tunnel here. Nope. Maybe it's just the country thing. Maybe it's like, you know, throw the melancholic in, give you the sad story. But I just can't picture this being like a jukebox favorite, you know?
I was going to say, what context is this playing in? When are people reaching for this song? I don't. I'm not seeing the audience.
It's a skip, right? I mean, surely it's a skip every time.
The audience is, yeah, people that listen to No Encore, I guess.
And like, Christmas is a difficult time, and I don't mean to diminish or like belittle, you know, the alcoholic factor thereof, and because, you know, there is, of course, you know, like this is a dangerous top five potentially. I myself find Christmas to be a very sad time of the year, but to lean into it to this level, and like, in fairness to John Denver, he commits and he makes you feel it.
It's so unvarnished, yeah. But there's no ambiguity. There's no
levity.
Kind of grappling with the themes of, yeah, it's just like, here is the scene and here is the horror and peace out. Like,
I will say from this point on, do not worry. My remaining three songs are a bit more laughable, but I had to bring it down. I'm sorry. This is where we are. It's Christmas.
It kind of reminded me of some of our worst religious songs and some of the horrors I unleashed on people then. So, chilling stuff. Let's bring some levity to proceedings. I'm going to get mainstream, all right? This is where I'm going to just kick off my shoes and get in the spirit. These are songs that I'm like actually drawn to of an occasion when I want to Christmas it up. There was one song I actually really wanted to include and was going to include, and I was reading a How We Made It, like Guardian article on it. And all the like below the line comments from Guardian readers were like, this song sucks, man. So here it is.
I'm driving home for Christmas. Oh, I can't wait to see those faces. I'm driving home for Christmas, yeah. Well, I'm moving down that line. And it's been so long, but I will be there. I sing this song.
It's like a warm hug, Chris Rea. Driving home for Christmas. Although, do you know what? After the last song, I'm now thinking, is this a dad with like some whiskey on his breath as he's driving? You could
and
go
severe,
very dark.
Severe rage issues, yeah.
Yeah, but no, it's a kind-hearted man and a kind-hearted artist. And this is very much embedded, I think it's fair to say, in like the heart of Christmas easy listening. It's got that jazzy piano going on. We're kind of behind enemy lines with this song, but there's a bunch of factors, I think, that combine to make this pretty brilliant. So there's no getting around the voice. I think the voice is amazing. It's you know, pack-a-day huskiness, right? It's it's charcoal-y, yeah. It's warm, it's inviting, it's, you know, chestnuts roasting on Chris Rea's open vocal cords, levels of warmth. He does sound like a man that's perpetually finishing a night shift.
Oh, yeah.
That's why I think it works really well.
Craig, I'm worried about the drive home. I always have been.
Yeah.
I'm worried that it's 4 a.m. and he's fucking wrecked, you know?
Yeah, it does feel... And,
snowing,
you know, he's got some
really
gifts
heavily
for, like, estranged kids, and the gifts aren't quite up to scratch, but he's doing his best, and is it going to end tragically? And I don't think it quite does. The story behind it, it's based on a true drive, a true story I can dip into. But I think, yeah, another element of why it's so great to me, it's desperately yearning. And I think the key thing it does is that it's about the anticipation of Christmas. It's kind of about the idea of Christmas. It's not about being with the people. It's about like the idea of something great coming in the middle of all this darkness. And I think, I mean, most people would say, you know, even for kids, the build up to Santa, the build up to Christmas is kind of the exciting bit. It lasts far longer than the Christmas morning, which is, you know, the day itself comes and goes and people enjoy or do not enjoy that to varying degrees. But I think the concept of Christmas is so pure, and that's what he's desperately reaching for as he veers off the road. Or no, he doesn't, he stays on the road.
Jesus Christ, give me the real story here. I want to hear the real story.
It's a pretty sweet story. So he wrote it in like 1978, which was like a whole 10 years before it actually came out, and he was a really struggling musician at the time. He was at Abbey Road, but he had like no cash, and his record label were basically like, you're going nowhere, we're not giving you any more cash. So his wife had to come and collect him in like their old Austin Mini. He couldn't afford like a train ticket to get back to Middlesbrough, where he's from. He's obviously Middlesbrough's answer to Sufjan Stevens. So she drove from Middlesbrough to London, which I believe is about 4 or 5 hours of a drive. He hopped in the car and they immediately drove back. So that was a long day for her. And as they were driving back, he just jokingly started singing Driving Home for Christmas. And they like cracked up. And he's like, oh yeah, there's something kind of in that. And he was like looking around at the other people. And he's like, yeah, we're kind of all in this together. And like the traffic's shit and things aren't great, but interesting. And they got home and it was like 3 in the morning. They made it home. It was freezing cold. And there was a check there, like on the doormat, for like one of his songs had become a hit in the US, like a minor hit. And there was a check for like 15 grand, which bought them a house, like a proper house they were renting at the time. And everything kind of turned around from that point. He put the kind of the idea for song in the back pocket and revisited it in like kind of his garage in like August, 10 years later, with like a mate of his. And they were like, oh yeah, this is the song. This is kind of where it all started. So pretty nice. I like that it's kind of parochial and very British, and it's, they're driving to Middlesbrough, but there's a reference to like driving down that freeway. It's like, there's no freeway to Middlesbrough, but it works.
When you say it's very British, is it a bit Tory? Because like for me, Craig, my big criticism of this song is it's just supermarket music, right?
It is, but I think it's smuggling in some actual substance, you know what I mean? And I think he's believable. I think his vocal totally sells it. He's been there. It's like, you know, hard fought. It's not Tory because it's very kind of working class and getting back to the kind of the mundane thing, I guess. It's just, it's the little details that I think sets this apart from the kind of more vacuous stuff, the elevator music. But it's using that kind of format, I think, really, really well. I don't think he particularly likes this himself. Like, he's kind of like a blues guy. And I think his fan base, who are probably on those Guardian comments, are like, he's actually got way better stuff than this. Like, in the comments, someone said they named another song and they're like, it's a far darker Christmas song, but it's much better. Not exactly party stuff. And I thought, do you know what? Go fuck yourself. I want a darker Christmas song. I want Driving Home for Christmas.
You want 2 for 1 at Morrison's, and you're going to get it. But we're going to get next, though. Go on, I think you still have some more to say about this, do you?
Yeah, no, there was a great quote from him, like, where he's, I think he only played it once or twice live, and he was badgered into doing it one Christmas at the, like, Apollo or something like that. And he thought, fuck it, if we're going to do it, like, we're going to go big. And he got, like, snow cannons. Yeah, he said, if I'm going to sing this fucking song, we're going to do it properly. So we hired 12 snow cannons. We put 3 feet of artificial snow into the stalls. And the venue then charged me 12 grand to clean it all up. Never did it again. So kind of a bit bah humbug. But then he reveals that if he's ever stuck on the road on like the M25, he'll wind down the window and start singing I'm Driving Home for Christmas at people in cars beside him. And he goes, they love it. It's like giving them a present.
Oh my
God. I do love that. That's great.
Pretty good. So, I want to say, by the way, I've only just noticed, Craig's wearing a very nice scarf, by the way. A very wintry, Christmassy scarf.
Yeah, the heat muscle on.
He's wearing a red and black tartan scarf, and he looks great. He's also lit by... is your electricity gone? Because you're lit by, like, what looks like candlelight right now.
No, the heating is... it's just the kind of mood lighting I need, and the heating has just gone on. I was so busy that I forgot to press the boost on it, so, yeah, it was quite cold when we started. Man. But I'm warmed up now, Dave.
The problems we have, and I have a problem at number 3 here. Let's have some back-of-the-pub bollocks, shall we? Santa Claus is coming to town. Absolute inexcusable nonsense from Bruce Springsteen there with his cover of Santa Claus is Coming to Town, a song originally written by J. Fred Coots and Haven Gillespie in 1934, I believe. Bruce did a version in the 70s, I want to say. I think he might release in the 80s. Complete garbage. Just, like, horrific. And, like, I don't need. Is he being ironic? Like, what's the point of having? Like, even the clip there gives me chills in the worst possible way. Where it's like, this absolute clown, you know, having a giggle, having a stupid fucking faux Santa Claus laugh track. He can't keep it together, Craig, because he's having just so much fun. Well, it was just very, so raucous.
Yeah. I don't think Bruce does irony, does he?
No,
that's
why.
I don't think he's ever done irony, and I don't think he's doing it here. And I, like, yeah, as soon as the kind of the opening of the music came in, I knew which clip you'd picked, and it was that kind of guffawing of, like, isn't this, what's so funny, Bruce?
What's so fucking funny? I don't get it. I mean, like, I guess you had to be there, you know?
And which is the problem. Anytime you're seeing a piece of art where the people creating it had a hilarious time and, like, there was lots of in-jokes and they're just yucking it up, it's never good for the viewer slash listener. It's not here. And this somehow, I think, is kind of quite well regarded.
It is.
Yeah. Like, there's a lot of, like, US-based lists that I noticed where I don't think they've quite got the exposure to some of the better stuff from, you know, across the pond. So they seem to just have, you know, this kind of very American-centric view of songs that came out. So this ends up usually placing about second or third in terms of, like, all-time best Christmas songs.
If you look at the like, I know the YouTube comments are obviously, like, you know, the, you know, Dave's favorite insane corner of the internet, and usually you're going to get positivity. And, like, it's sad because, like, you delve into the YouTube comments on this one, and, like, a lot of them are like, you know, oh, this was my dad's song and he's gone now and I wish, blah, blah. And you're like, okay, that's sad and I'm sorry, but, like, people attaching these really personal memories to this, I'm like, what the fuck? I get that Bruce is your blue collar Jesus, but good lord, this is just beyond obnoxious and honestly offensive. I hate it, Craig. It hates me.
I hate it too. I hate it. It hates all of us, really. That laughter, you can hear the hatred, the glee. Oh,
painful. Painful, yeah, stuff.
Enough of the blue collar Jesus. Let's get back to the real Jesus, shall we? Lest we forget the religious aspect of this holiday. Let's get a little sacred. Let's enjoy the stillness. Let's repent and then rejoice. Here we go. Had to do it.
Thank God for that kick in. I was worried for a second.
Oh man. So this is my choice. Oh Holy Night. I do love it. But I was picking my songs last night and I was extremely tired. Dave, as you know, Adam, as you know, I was on a shoot all day. I was out of my mind. And I was listening to Oh Holy Night and Oh What a Night got stuck in my head. I had no time to pull clips together, but I spent 20 minutes dragging that mashup together because I just couldn't. I don't know. I'm losing it. It's been a long year.
Hey, Craig, it's Christmas. Like it's a time for experimental music.
Every time. Yeah. You need a bit of Frankie Valli in your life sometimes. But that was John Williams' version of Oh Holy Night. It was written by Adolphe Adam and Placide Capot, who were, I think, like the Victorian era Steely Dan. I don't know. It's a well-known Christmas carol. I think it's the best of them. I really love it. And yeah, I guess we have to get into the fact that this is taken from Home Alone, one of my favorite films, probably my favorite film. It is the church scene. It's Kevin's reckoning with old man Marley and very thoughtful meditation on and conversation on fear and family and regret and Christmas jumpers. It can get you beaten up as a child. And I love this version. It's that organ sound is humongous and that kind of like vibrating thing is great. I find it immensely haunting. It does actually give me chills and probably a lot of nostalgia tied to it, but it still does it for me every time. I think that melody is unbeatable. And I wanted something that represented the more traditional end of things because a lot of it is dross, but I think we don't talk about it a lot. And yeah, you know, undeniably, there's a lot of bullshit around the religious aspects of the holiday and religion in general. But I do think there's something to be said for like when religion's really firing on all cylinders and like creating, you know, awe-inspiring moments, it kind of makes you feel small and like insignificant, and that's somehow comforting. And I don't know, I think a song like this is trying to get at like a rhyme or reason to existence, but sometimes, yeah, the melody's just enough. And, you know, Celine Dion and Mariah Carey have covered it.
And they can't possibly be wrong. I must ask, I've always known you to know that Home Alone is your favorite film of all time, not just Christmas. But you did stumble there and you said one of, before you corrected yourself. Is there any film in the world that comes close to Home Alone for you? No matter what it is, no matter what the genre, I'm just like, I need some kind of perspective barometer here.
Yeah, it's Mulholland Drive, maybe. What a double bill. That actually might be a double bill that happens this Christmas.
Which do you watch first, though, is the real question there.
Oh, God. I don't think you can wrap up with Mulholland Drive, because then Christmas is totally ruined, or at least that night, right? You're just haunted eternally. I think you need the salvation at the end of Home Alone after the fever dream of Mulholland Drive. So maybe that's the way I'll do it. But yeah, I stumbled, I think, because I stumble quite a bit. But also, I think Home Alone's in its own weird category for me, where it's a yearly watch and it feels in a separate box to like more serious films. Do you know what I mean? I don't quite know what I'm getting at there, but it's Home Alone, dude. It's its own category.
Yeah, okay, that's fine. I mean, listen, we all stumble through life, Craig, and you're allowed to love what you love. Did you watch the new Home Alone? Have you got around to that yet?
I will never watch that.
Okay. So, back on the worst Christmas songs corner now for me, my silver medal. Usually on this show, to avoid copyright strikes, we try and keep it to 30 seconds. Adam, I preferred a longer clip this week. It's almost a minute. I would like you to play it in full. I think we should test this, because I think we need the full scope of this one. I really had my pick here. I've picked a specific iteration of it. The most recent one, I think. Adam, if you will.
Christmas bells that ring there are the clanging chimes of doom. Well, tonight we'll reach in out and touching you. Bring peace and joy this Christmas to us now.
Okay, Craig, so you had Perfect Day recently in a top five, and you challenged me to name who you heard. This is Band-Aid 30 from 2014, and Do They Know It's Christmas. Can you name the voices you heard there?
I think I only got to... It opens with Chris Martin, right?
Yes.
And then we have... Everything else was Bono. Bono was just lodged in my brain.
He's in there twice, in fairness, in that clip. So you also... Anyone else jump out to you? No?
Not particularly, no.
There's a very spirited vocal from Seal, who I love. I love Seal.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And I kind of want to exonerate him. Adam is correct. Adam has correctly guessed Ellie Goulding was
Ellie Goulding
in there.
Nice one, Adam.
With a very Ellie Goulding, like, I've got 5 seconds, I'm going to get my shit in moment. And the wonderful Sinead O'Connor. Adam, yeah, you are correct. Sinead O'Connor was in there as well.
Shit, of course. That was the moment I lost it, where it's just like the context of Sinead coming in with quite a passionate couple of lines.
Yeah,
it's just so off kilter.
Very spirited, and everyone's doing their job. I think we'll probably close the clip on Bono, but it moves into like Bastille and it's just, I think Olly Murs could be in there. I don't know, maybe I'm wrong. So Do They Know It's Christmas, of course, is a song written in 1984 by who, Craig? Who are the two chief songwriters?
Bob Geldof and Majeur.
Correct,
guess, right?
You are correct. And it was, of course, in reaction to television reports of the 1983 to 1995 famine in Ethiopia. Huge charity single, massive pop culture moment, lots of celebs. There was another version in 2004, which had a bad Dizzy Rascal verse amongst lots of other bad stuff too. I think Justin Hawkins from The Darkness apparently had a bit of a row with Bono over who would get the big line.
Bono prevailed, as he tends to do, and this was the 2014 edition, which had lots of people, including like Rita Ora and various others. Real quick, before I get into the history further, what do you think of the song, like the original song? Do you think it's a good song? Because it pops up on both good and bad Christmas lists.
I don't think it's like objectively dreadful melodically. I think the sentiment was kind of okay. I don't think those group things ever quite work. It's way better than the terrible American kind of version of We Are the World. I mean, that's just so mawkish and dreadful. I actually think there was some bite to the original, which they completely do away with in this version, right? So there's new lyrics. Bono had that kind of like killer line in the first one, and this time around it's changed. And I always liked that line where he says, "Well, thank God it tonight, thank God it's them instead of you."
Yeah.
Which was, you know, seen as controversial. But to me, that always struck as like, yeah, you know, isn't it good that you're in the position that you're in? And it kind of makes you think. I always like that
people
line.
Really took issue with that line. They thought it was, I mean, you know, you can get into the weeds here. They thought it was, people thought it was racist. People thought it was obviously just really kind of punching down. But I would agree with you. I thought it was meant to be like, you're privileged. You're listening to the song because you're privileged. Give us your fucking
like,
money.
Thank God it's them, right? Like, you know.
That's the point. If anything, but over the years,
sarcastic,
criticism.
Sarcastic, like, yeah.
Yeah, criticism led to him changing it to "Tonight we're reaching out and touching you." Okay.
Which sounds just gross.
So, in terms of the original composition of the song back in 1984, Paul Yates, who was with Bob Geldof at the time, they were in a relationship, she was doing a TV show and Ultravox were on it. Midger was there. Bob Geldof found this out and so he chatted to him and basically was like, why don't we do something to help, you know, the suffering in Ethiopia? So here's some outstanding Bob Geldof quotage from the time. Following the meeting, Bob Geldof immediately set about recruiting other well-known musicians to participate on the song. Here's the quote. I then rang Sting, and he said, yeah, count me in. And then Le Bon, Simon Le Bon, he just instantly said, tell me the date and we'll clear the diary. The same day I was passing by this antique shop, and who's standing in there but Gary Kemp, just about to go off on tour to Japan. He said he was mad for it. Wait 10 days until Spandau Ballet got back in the country. Suddenly it hit me. I thought, Christ, we've got the real top boys here. All the big names in
top.
The top
boys.
The top boys.
In a private school or something.
All the big names in pop are suddenly ready and willing to do this. I knew then that we were off. I decided to go for all the rest of the faces and started to ring everyone up, asking them to do it. So yeah, the 2014 edition that I've picked here, which is the most anemic. One Direction, Sam Smith, Ed Sheeran, Emma Lesande, Ellie Goulding, Rita Ora, Bastille, Guy Garvey, Chris Martin, Bono. You name it. Here they are. At the third time Bono pitched up, of course, because he won't miss it. So this one was about the Ebola epidemic at the time. And so it attracted a lot of criticism. People said that it was a colonial Western-centric viewpoint and contained condescending stereotypical descriptions of Africa. Notably that Bono phrase that we talked about. Criticism remained despite things being changed. A musician by the name of Fuse ODG turned in a request to be there and said that the lyrics of the song do not reflect what Africa truly is. He cited lyrics such as "There is no peace and joy in West Africa this Christmas," saying he goes to Ghana every year for the sole purpose of peace and joy. So saying such lyrics would be a complete lie. Lots of people just saying it was unoriginal and redundant, reinforces stereotypes. It was just full of ridiculous, outdated concepts. Lily Allen refused to appear on it because she thought it was smug and preferred to donate actual money. An Ebola survivor by the name of William Pooley said it was cultural ignorance and cringeworthy. Bob Geldof responded to this
worse
by saying,
"Worse than Ebola."
Bob Geldof responded to this man and said, "Please, it's a pop song. Relax." He said, "Anyone critical of lyrics could quote fuck off." Good man, Bob. And in fairness to Bob Geldof and Midger, they themselves have in fact said, like, "Look, yeah. It wasn't great, was it? I'm responsible for two of the worst songs in history. The other one is We Are the World." And Midger has said, "Look, it's nothing to do with music. It was about generating money, and that's what it did, and that's what was important. But it's trotted out every now and then, and even if it makes money, Craig, I think it's pretty terrible." So that's my number two.
Yeah, I agree. My number two is the song that was kept off the top spot by the original Do They Know It's Christmas?
Yeah.
1984, Wham, Last Christmas. Super classy, spectacular pop that's also drenched in Christmas. One of their best songs. Other artists should take note. This is how it's done. Amazing video as well, with amazing coats and amazing longing looks and amazing dyed hair. Blonde hair.
Amazing everything.
And amazing in how George Michael basically did it all himself. So it was written by George Michael in his childhood bedroom. He played the introduction and the chorus melody to Andrew Ridgeley, and Ridgeley called it a moment of absolute wonder. And they recorded it in August, as most of these things are recorded. George Michael wrote, performed, produced, and played every single instrument on the track. So you've got that Lindrum going, the Roland synth. It's one of those prime examples of where 80s synth pop becomes very tied to the Christmas season, I guess. Because you've got those kind of icy synths used in a really buoyant way. And just, yeah, that always kind of, there's something quite tinsely about it. And it's to a tremendous effect here. It just sounds to me like it's so tied to that kind of soundtrack of other Christmas songs, despite being better than absolutely most of them. But it feels like, you know, someone, the kind of narrator, just moving through like their umpteenth Christmas gathering of the year and like glancing across the room with someone like Lost Sweetheart. And then, you know, I'm sure this is playing quite often in the Vic, in like the Christmas episode of EastEnders.
You've got Martin a glass Kemp, into someone's face.
Being killed on that episode or something. So it's tied to a lot of those kind of moments. And it's tremendous. I mean, George Michael, we talk about him probably a fair bit on this
show. Absolute fucking legend.
And we should. Absolute legend. Sadly passed on Christmas Day, of course. And that was... that year that happened, which is probably nearly 5 years ago now, kind of word reached people pretty late on that Christmas. And I remember
where I was.
Stephen's Day, just playing plenty of Wham and George Michael. And I've kind of kept that tradition up a little bit on Stephen's Day over the last couple of years. So, yeah, he's tied to that day in a lot of ways now. And, yeah, the kind of the main thing that came from that, aside from the great tragedy of it, was just the amazing stories that came out about him, just as a proper kind of lovely bloke. And there was a lot of, you know, here's the top 10, you know, best random acts of kindness from George Michael lists that started creeping up, of just like guy that went under the radar and just did a lot for people. And, you know, if that doesn't scream Christmas spirit, I don't know what does, Dave.
Yeah, I adore this song. I'm shocked it's not your number one. I think it's the greatest Christmas song of all time. I think it's an absolutely perfect piece of music. I think it's wonderful. I think it's magical. I think it's amazing. I even love the kind of half-ironic, eyebrow-raised cover by that UK indie band that didn't quite make it, Peace, back in 2014.
Oh yeah, that's fun. Yeah,
I love their cover. Real quick, I will say I've alluded to it. I've talked about it. I've mentioned it a million times. I struggle with Christmas. I think it's a very difficult time. This song actually makes me feel good. It actually does. It doesn't, like some Christmas songs do. Some Christmas songs and Christmas things do in fact trigger me in a bad way. But this song, I actually love it. It contains what I want to feel at Christmas, but don't always. And real quick, if I can be preachy for a second, for anyone listening who also struggles with Christmas, I'm right there with you. It's a tough fucking time, but we're going to get through it. Do not worry about it. And in fairness, if you need a bit of a laugh, my number one should do it. Any guesses, Craig?
Oh my God. I don't know.
Okay.
Need a bit of a laugh. Yeah, just give it to me.
Let's go. Number one.
Oh, fucking McCartney, of course. Of course, McCartney. That only comes this time of year. Simply having a wonderful Christmas time. Simply having a wonderful Christmas time. The choir of children. Why, yes. As Craig's reaction will tell you, it's Paul McCartney and Wings, who didn't perform on this. It was just him, but he credited them anyway. What a nice Christmas gift for them. It's a wonderful Christmas time, of course. The track is regarded as one of McCartney's weaker compositions by numerous music critics, but it has been covered by numerous artists. Complete nonsense, Craig. Synth bollocks and just crazy just noodling. After me talking about how associated that kind of synth sound is with Christmas, they just sound like kind of phasers or like laser guns going off in the background for no real rhyme or reason.
So bad.
I don't know what's happening.
It's
in
so
song.
Bad, but Craig, people love this song. It makes them feel like Christmas.
It's not your number one, is it?
There's nothing to it. There's nothing. There's absolutely nothing to it. It's just such a, you know, we were talking about the genius of Paul McCartney, or at least I was. You were listening to me talk about the genius of Paul McCartney. We talked about Get Back and how he just kind of, you know, magicked Get Back into existence, and doing that thing where he starts with the tune and then the words just fall into place. And in that instance, some interesting words and some that you can attach real meaning to. And in this instance, simply having a wonderful Christmas time means nothing. The verse is going to mean nothing. Sounds a bit weird and witchy. I don't know, but...
It does sound witchy, doesn't it?
There's a sinister edge
to this that I don't like. And also...
But I don't think he intends it.
No.
I think he just had a collection of words that worked and fit the meter.
It's so insistent as well. It feels like forced fun, you know? That's another reason why I don't like it. It just feels very like, come on! Smile, it might never happen. I'm like,
arrived in like the 80s when McCartney being around for so long, like we'd had the John Lennon and Yoko Christmas song, which is about, you know, Happy Christmas, War is over, and a decade prior, this felt like McCartney going, okay, I might as well get around to doing my Christmas song. Do you know what I mean? It just...
So it's a box ticking
real
exercise.
Kind of box tick. Yeah, yeah, totally. Totally. And, you know, it's a very lucrative game if you hit it off with it. And, like, this gets played so much.
All the time.
People do love this song.
All the time. Yeah, for some people, like, it's not Christmas until this goes on. Nah, man, my number one. I just, it upsets me. Yeah, I mean, like, I have very little else to say about it. It's a pox. A pox on Christmas. A pox on House McCartney. A plague on House McCartney.
My number one is maybe the song that started that whole arms race for the Christmas number one. And it's time we ask ourselves a very important question. Dave, are you hanging up your stocking on the wall?
Oh my God, no.
Had to be, Dave. It's Slade. It's Merry Xmas, everybody. And it does feel to me like the archetypical Christmas song. It's the urtext, if you will. Came out in 1973 and was gigantic. I think it sold like 500,000 records in its opening week. At the time, it's tough to believe it, but Slade were Britain's coolest and biggest band. And this was their final number one song. And I guess they've been so associated with it ever since that you forget that they were actually a massive band prior to this song. There's just so many elements that I think were then pilfered for other songs that are actually pretty decent as well. It's kind of the granddaddy of songs going for Christmas number one, being kind of anthemic with it. But I don't think, when I listen to this, it's not diminished as a result. And, you know, in the way, sadly, that Fairytale New York didn't make my list, I know you have a huge dislike for that song. I was talking to my cousin Caleb during the week, and he said,
get on board.
The point he said made was Fairytale New York is either the greatest Christmas song of all time or the worst one. And for a long time, I was thinking, as a piece of writing, I still think it's tremendous. I have a lot of love for it. I went back to it this week and I can't enjoy it at all. And I checked my phone first thing this morning and I was seeing tweets starting about the whole controversy, and
yep.
I'm just so bored with it, and it's just all the context around that song. Hopefully one day I'll enjoy it again, but I can't now. But I can still enjoy this, and it's just a very simple song. It's got that togetherness thing. It's the vibe of you're over the kind of turkey sweats. There's people calling around. All Top of the Pops on. You know, your gran is kind of drunk on sherry. It's those vibes. It was the same year as Wizards.
I was going to say.
Yeah.
I wish it could be Christmas every day. Yeah.
They came out the same year, yeah. And I have a lot of time for that song as well. But I do remember at the time as a kid watching those clips, and Roy Wood from Wizard kind of terrified me.
Me too. I was so scared.
I was like, he's going, those kids singing along, he's going to abduct them after this. I'm sure Roy Wood's a lovely fella, and you know, he was in ELO, great guy, but Noddy Holder though, and Slade, I was like, he's the cheeky chappy, he's the slightly drunk uncle calling around with like maybe an Irish football top or like 20 quid. He's the guy you want to be hanging out with. And do you know what? I do think it actually works on a few different levels, because it has, again, kind of quite a British record, but it's got the kind of melancholy and the kind of look to the future now. It's only just begun. It's a bit of wishful thinking. It's very kind of, I guess, working class, and we'll just struggle through. I love the details to it. I just think it hits a lot of different levels. And to me, it just, if I had to pick a song that kind of screams Christmas, this literally screams Christmas. He literally yells, it's Christmas. And I fucking do love that bit. Like, I actually do. And I love also the fact that I discovered this week that it's not on the original version. It was added to the reissue the next year. And of course, this was reissued and reissued, reissued. And someone made the point that, like, it's literally Noddy Holder screaming, I'm making a million quid from this song. And you can hear that joy. It's like... And that's my number one.
It's a great number one. Fair play. Thank it's you. Kind of undeniable. I mean, I will say real quick before we close off here, I will say, when you said Christmas number one arms race, I was kind of hoping you were going to go with Rage Against the Machine, Killing in the Name, as some kind of hilarious, ironic throwback, but nonetheless.
Yeah, not a Christmas song.
You've gone for a classic, and fair enough. I think it was a classic list. It's a classic time of year. It's a difficult time of year. It's a joyful time of year. Make it your own. Don't put too much pressure on yourself. Look after each other. Yes, I'm saying all of this on the 3rd of December when the episode comes out. It's Christmas, everybody, and I want to say a huge thank you to our own Father Christmas, the greatest man of all, jolly old Saint Nick, Sonic Architect Adam. He is the best.
He is.
He gives us the gift of audio every single week, and we are very lucky to have it. So, and to you, listener, I hope you get everything you want this Christmas. We're not done yet, though. There are more episodes to come. We're not signing off for the year just yet. But, you know, stay safe, look after yourself. It's a stressful time of year. It's a strange time of year. Some tunes in there, though. Fair play. My name is Dave Hanready. His name is Craig Fitzpatrick. This has been No Encore. There will be no encore. And I'm off to hang my stocking on the wall. Goodbye.